lost in our Bill of Rights is the freedom to hear uncensored ideas and opinions, to think your own thoughts, and to say what's on your mind. We couldn't have liberty without it. Now, more than ever, it's good to spout off, to listen, debate, and participate. Here's your host of Spouting Off, commentator, columnist, and all-around rabble-rouser, Karen Cataline.
Good afternoon, good evening, whenever you're listening to Spouting Off from our flagship station at WSMN 1590 AM and 95.3 FM Nashua, New Hampshire. If you'd like to weigh in, and oh my, is there lots to weigh in about, and I will be doing so momentarily, 603-816-1590. And this show goes to a lot of places after it leaves us when we broadcast it live, but live is best. We like live. We like alive, and we like live. Sometimes I don't like to weigh in on the same things everybody else is talking about, especially since there's so much people are talking about. But I plan to weigh in on this. Every conservative, at least that I know, is talking about the departure of Tucker Carlson from Fox News. It so happens that yesterday I was taping a show. I was a guest host, which I do frequently, for the Alan Nathan Show. And my whole first monologue, that's a two-hour show. I do it often. And my first monologue was all about Tucker Carlson and his gutsy 6-minute video with the title, "What You're Watching Is Not a Political Movement, It's Evil." That was Tucker Carlson. I'm going to play you a couple of those audio clips that I played yesterday from this 6-minute video. And I do believe I posted it on Twitter. It is very important. Tucker Carlson himself has made a lot of movement in the last couple of years. I stopped watching him regularly because I didn't have Fox News anymore. Tucker Carlson was, for me, the only reason to get Fox News, and it just didn't seem to be enough. But he has been stellar in his courage and in his reporting, and especially in his keen observations of what is happening. So while I was on the air, broadcasting, actually taping, I looked at the news and there was the breaking news. Now, the radical leftist propaganda media is spinning their propellers off, as well as, and to carry the water for Fox News, to tell us that this was an amicable parting and it was a mutual consent. And then we find out that Tucker Carlson found out that he would no longer be with Fox News on the very same day he was probably preparing for his Monday night show. So, gee, is that an amicable parting? He didn't get a chance to say goodbye to any of his listeners. He was summarily dismissed. But people like The View, who are cheering and singing and going crazy as if Tucker Carlson is somehow their nemesis. They control, the radical left controls almost everything already, but they cannot tolerate dissent of any kind. Communism can never tolerate dissent. The radical left has gone from pro-First Amendment to flat-out tyranny and authoritarianism. And that's what we are watching, with really not skipping much of a beat. With regard to Tucker Carlson, I got a lot of phone calls. A lot of people's phones blew up. Did you hear what happened? Right? They're picking off every conservative. I don't know what that will bode for Tucker Carlson. I do know that he has a $20 million a year contract that Fox will have to pay, which apparently for the owner, the 92-year-old owner of Fox News, Rupert Murdoch, is chump change. So they have to pay him $20 million a year. and he has no contingencies in his contract. He can go anywhere or say anything he wants. I hope he takes plenty of time because he has the goodwill of many conservatives who watched and saw him stand up for truth again and again and again. And that doesn't mean you have to agree with him. It means that he stood up and had the courage to say what was on his mind, to do the stories he wanted to do. Now, there's a lot of suspicion, and rightfully so, that this came after a huge, massive settlement, $700 million or billion. You know what? Nobody even knows anymore. You know, what's a billion here or there? I have to look that up. I think it's 700 million. To Dominion Voting Systems. And right after that, some people are speculating that that was part of the settlement, is that they had to get rid of Tucker Carlson. I also read, I'm just repeating some of the things I read, that Paul Ryan was behind the anti-Trump stance that Fox began to take and has taken consistently, which is why they have consistently lost viewers over time. But Sundance, this is one of the commentators that people send me. I don't know if you've ever seen Sundance. It is a great column that he wrote about thoughts he had about Tucker Carlson. And what's important to remember is, you know, we're not getting all the facts. We don't know everything. And to think you do is folly, is a fool's errand, because there's so much going on behind the scenes with all of it that when they tell you a narrative and they tell you you're not to think anything different, that's when you question the narrative. The thing Sundance said about Tucker Carlson was, it was 100% ideological. 100% ideological. And you know what? I believe that that is the reason for them going after Trump with the relentless hatred and vitriol and being willing to frame a president and raid his house and arrest him on preposterous charges. It's 100% ideological. So what's part of the ideology that they don't want anybody hearing, seeing, or commenting or questioning? What is that ideology? Well, I go back to the audio that I played yesterday that I'm about to share with you. This is but one example of Tucker Carlson having the courage and the guts to say what's on his mind, to say the emperor has no clothes in a sea of people telling you that the emperor is beautifully dressed. We're going to do that first cut right now. It's 6 minutes. I couldn't put it all in there. I didn't want to play it all. Couldn't play it all. But here's the first cut of Tucker Carlson. Go.
What's the point of child sacrifice? Well, there's no policy goal entwined with that. No, that's a theological phenomenon. And that's kind of the point I'm making. None of this makes sense in conventional political terms. When people or crowds of people, or the largest crowd of people at all, which is the federal government, the largest human organization in human history, decide that the goal is to destroy things, destruction for its own sake. Hey, let's tear it down. What you're watching is not a political movement, it's evil. So if you want to assess, and I'll put it in non, and I'll stop with this, non-specific theological terms, and just say, if you want to know what's evil and what's good, what are the characteristics of those? And by the way,
Okay, well, he goes on to talk about something else there. We went on a little long there, but he said it's not a political movement, it's evil. Now, this is, if you hear the echo in the room, this is Tucker Carlson giving a speech from the Heritage Foundation, and he makes a point that yours truly has been making a long time. Long-time traditional conservatives are still applying the same political labels, titles, and strategies to a time in which we are living well past the Rubicon right now. You can't apply the same terms as we used to. That if, and he goes on to talk about this, if you could just make a sane argument, people would say, well, you know what? You're right. We've long since passed that. And you'll hear that cut in a moment. We need to look at it in a very new way than the way we've been. Let's go ahead and hear the other cut because we're almost running out of time. Mr. Producer, cut two.
I'm just noting what's super obvious. Like those of us who are in our mid-50s are caught in the past in the way that we think about this. One side's like, no, you know, I've got this idea and we've got this idea and let's have a debate about our ideas. They don't want a debate. Those ideas won't produce outcomes that any rational person would want under any circumstances. Those are manifestations of some larger force acting upon us. It's just so obvious. It's completely obvious. And I think two things. One, we should say that and stop engaging in these totally fraudulent debates where we are using the terms that we used in 1991 when I started at Heritage as if maybe, you know, I could just win the debate if I marshaled more facts. I've tried that, doesn't work. And two, maybe we should all take just like 10 minutes a day to say a prayer about it.
How about that? So there are forces acting upon us. That's what he says. He speaks out about indefensible ideas like maiming a whole generation of children. And I guess this is what Rupert Murdoch doesn't want anybody to hear. It is 100%. As Sundance says, ideological. You don't kill the golden goose. Tucker Carlson was the golden goose at Fox. We've already seen Fox Corp go down in stock well over 4 points now. That translates into mucho bucks here. And why would they be willing to do that? Well, they just had to pay this Dominion voting systems. There's so much more we don't know, but what we do know is that the narrative that the left is pushing and that the Trump-hating right is pushing ain't true. So we're going to leave it there for now. You can write me, Karen at KarenCataline.com. Tell me what you think is going on. We have a couple of great guests coming up. Don't go away. We'll have those right after this commercial break. You're listening to Spouting Off. I'm Karen Cataline. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Spouting Off with Karen Cataline.
Hello, I'm Mike Lindell, inventor of MyPillow. Thanks to your support, you've helped make MyPillow become one of the fastest growing companies in America. Over the last 12 years, you've helped MyPillow create thousands of jobs right here in the USA. Every MyPillow is made with passion here in my home state of Minnesota to ensure you get the best sleep of your life.
One of the things that I really like about MyPillow is the support. It gives my neck a little hug.
I've never slept better in my life. What's better than a great night's sleep?
Call or go online to take advantage of my best offer ever. For a limited time, when you use your promo code, you can get premium MyPillows regularly $69.98, now only $29.98. With our 60-day money-back guarantee, you have nothing to lose.
Sleep well, America!
Call 1-800-867-0416 and use the promo code RAM, R-A-M. That's 1-800-867-0416 and use the promo code RAM.
For the best night's sleep in the whole wide world, visit MyPillow.com.
Wouldn't it be great if life came with a remote control? You know, you could hit pause when you needed to, or hit rewind. Like that time you knocked down that wasp's nest.
Uh-oh.
Or that time you forgot to roll up your windows in the car wash.
Fantastic.
Yeah, a remote control would have come in handy then. Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. With early diagnosis and a few healthy changes like managing your weight, getting active, stopping smoking, and eating healthier, you can stop prediabetes before it leads to type 2 diabetes. It's easy to learn your risk. Take the one-minute test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Life doesn't come with a remote control.
Yikes!
So you're on your own with the wasps. You have the power to take control of prediabetes. Visit doihaveprediabetes.org today. That's doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
Spouting Off with Karen Cataline will return in a moment.
The Reading Foundation provides evaluation and tutorial programs based upon the Orton-Gillingham philosophy of learning, based upon the study of language, how children acquire language, and the mechanisms involved in learning. All the learning pathways of the brain, visual, auditory, kinesthetic, and tactile, are addressed and strengthened to build a strong foundation for the acquisition of reading skills. If you are interested in learning more, please contact the Reading Foundation for more information. The Reading Foundation is at 10 Northern Boulevard, Unit 19, Amherst, New Hampshire, 03031. Or you can email us at readingfoundation_rf@yahoo.com. And of course, you can call anytime at 603-882-0992. The Reading Foundation, Amherst, New Hampshire.
Sign up for Karen's newsletter and read her columns at KarenCataline.com. Now back to Spouting Off with Karen Cataline.
Welcome back, everyone, to Spouting Off. We're going to zoom right in here. I am so delighted to have with us a professor of politics at Hillsdale College. Full disclosure, I am a huge supporter of Hillsdale College, have been for more than a decade, well over a decade, visited there several times, and this is a treat to have this next guest. Kevin Slack, where he teaches political philosophy, American political thought, including American progressivism, liberalism, and radicalism, totally in line with my monologue that I just gave. Welcome, Professor Sled, to have you with us here on Spouting Off.
Good to be here.
Boy, what a relevant and gutsy, it's too bad, you gotta have guts these days to tell the truth. However, I'm looking at a little press brief, War on the American Republic, and specifically how liberalism became despotism. This is on the money with what we talk about here all the time. Why don't you give us an overview and tell us, for people who don't understand or are not watching or living under a rock, how liberalism became despotism?
Sure. The book started off as a treatment of the different movements on the American left. So much of it is a chronology and it's historical, but it takes us to, the 2020 COVID and the lockdowns to 2021. And so I try to situate these terms in their historical context. So when we say progressives, oftentimes we refer to, say, the old progressives, 1880 to 1920. But then there's often a group that calls itself very moderate. These are the groups that that are liberal today, and you can trace the use of that word to the mid-century liberals, the 1930s to the 1960s. But then we use the word progressive today always to refer to those who are on the far left, and that's a group that rises up in the late 1960s. And, of course, the different elements of that group have become far more radical over time and have changed over time. You know, for example, the focus on transgenderism in the last 10 years. So I try to look at the historical roots of those words that we use. And why is it that those that are often the centrists in the Democratic Party are always seem to take second place to the radicals in the Democratic Party, right? So if you support the Democratic Party, Joe Biden and so on, you're supporting a much more radical agenda. So I think it was curiosity just about those movements, particularly in the 20th century, but then also during the COVID lockdowns, a real concern that many of the freedoms that we take for granted as Americans were under threat and might be permanently. And so I try to conclude the book with an assessment of those threats.
That's excellent. You're such a scholar, and you can give us a lot of history of this. But I just want to look at it from a slightly more, on the ground point of view, and then you could bring in the history. We talk all the time about how the cornerstone ideas of liberalism and Democrats, and I believe the radical left has completely taken over the Democrat Party, but all the things they used to say that they believed in more than anything else have been turned upside down and on its head. Just as one example, they led the charge on littering. Keep America beautiful. Now you can defecate on the street and live in a tent and trash your city. Everything, including the cherished sacred cow of feminism, now they can't even define a woman, and it's okay for men to pummel women in sports. They've turned it on their head. So from your perspective, how is it possible? I think some of us watching always knew that when you're on one bandwagon, it's easy to just jump off one and jump on another. But how is there a scholarly answer to the fact that standard liberals have totally shifted opposite and upside down to what they said they always believed? A censorship. They were the free speech people. Now they're not.
Yeah, I think if you compare though those mid-century liberals, those who always claim to be moderate, to be in favor of reason, in favor of the scientific method, if you compare them to the radicals that rise up in the late 60s, the radicals never took those positions. They were the ones who argued against free speech. Usually conservatives will go back, I think, correctly to Herbert Marcuse on repressive tolerance, somebody like Johann Galtung, who argued that speech is violence. And their solution was, is you ought never to allow speech on the right, only to allow free speech on the left. The reason actually made by those on the left was pretty persuasive. It is that all of those liberals who claim to espouse toleration at the research universities in the 50s and into the 60s, really what they were engaged in was a way to disarm young people who came in with certain political values, religious values, and to introduce them into a realm of subjectivity, right? So you come into politics as a Christian or as a conservative, and so you're introduced into a classroom where everyone has their own subjective opinion. Those on the left look at that environment, and they said, well, this is just a way of stripping away the ideals that someone might use to counter the status quo. And so you ought not to tolerate free speech on the right, just on the left. So those who were radicals never embraced that position that free speech was simply good in and of its own sake for discovering truth. Rather, the regime ought to be used to further truth with a capital T. So you have those who are the liberal centrists, and I think they give way to those who are radicals, not just in culture, but broadly so in the Democratic Party. And then I add one more, and that is once you have this union between those in large corporations with this identity politics priesthood, then you're going to find those positions being taken within large corporations as well. And so in one of the chapters, there's a section called How the Democratic Party Became the Party of the Rich. And you can look to, say, those new Democrats in the 1980s, and they begin to shift over to this position in supporting monopoly capitalism. And then eventually that marriage is made complete in what we call the Great Awakening in the 2010s. And that's where large corporations begin to fully sponsor these radical movements. And so you're going to find the largest corporations and those in government, and they're not going to have the positions of the older liberals with regard to free speech. Rather, they're going to argue for its suppression.
It's dizzying. Really, it's dizzying, Professor Slack. I found myself wondering, well, what about Berkeley and all the free speech stuff? I'll give another example. My husband and I are binge watching. I realize it may not be very scholarly, but it's awfully funny. We're binge watching The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, in which, and I don't expect you to know this, but maybe you do. There is a character, and there's fictional characters mixed with real characters, and Lenny Bruce is portrayed prominently in this show. And I'm always ranting at the TV because Lenny Bruce, while it had to do with pornography and obscenity and stuff, he was a darling of the left. They loved him in talking about free speech and authoritarian government, et cetera, et cetera. Now, if he said anything against gays, if he said anything they didn't like, he'd be back in jail just as quickly as ever with the left of today. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, you could find a parallel in if you went back to the 1990s, it would have been absurd. And this is relatively recently. It would have been absurd to think that you would find those on the radical left who were in favor of the largest companies like Disney. They were always criticizing large corporations. Everything
yes.
was about, you know, the 1% and the 99%. And that's all changed. And again, I think this goes back to that that great awakening where you find a literal priesthood. I mean, you know, I use that phrase, but it's not just finding a silly analogy. You go back to the medieval period, there's a state church. And that's what we have, right, in education today,
right.
where these are state-funded positions. Every corporation, every school has compliance officers.
Yes.
that are supposed to make calls on these very sacred principles that we hold in American society, or at least that the left holds. And if you don't follow those, you're going to lose your job. You're going to have to undergo all kinds of training. People that are accused of violating these moral norms, they apologize and they ask for re-education. So there's very much a state church that's risen up, and I think we see that since the 60s, but we see its end in the last 10 years and how disturbing it is.
Wow. And that sounds like despotism, isn't it? That's the subtitle of your book, ladies and gentlemen, War on the American Republic, How Liberalism Became Despotism. And that is exactly what we are watching through either bullying, bribery, and blackmail. I call it the three Bs of large corporations. Walmart, the left hated Walmart until they didn't, when Walmart succumbed to putting little signs on the floor to tell you where to walk when you shop at a Walmart during the pandemic. With our few minutes left into trying our best to get as much wisdom from you as we can, is there actually a scholarly answer or a scholarly way to fight back against this? I mean, most people are scratching their heads today and going, I see what's happening. I'm seeing growing despotism in this country and they're winning. What has traditionally worked? What can we do since everyday citizens are really in the crosshairs of all this?
Yeah, and I just to add on to that, I think what's really disturbed parents is this is taking place at the elementary school level. It's taking place at the level of their local libraries, where you find all this gender-affirming care propaganda being foisted on their own children. And that's what makes you realize this is very much a priesthood, that that they're trying to intervene in those intimate relations that are most important to American citizens. I would also, when you say a scholarly response, I think there are a whole bunch of scholarly responses. The real key is, can we actually go back to the older idea of what it means to be a citizen? Can we try to rekindle some of those older networks? And there, I think it's rather a matter of actual political engagement. And I think for that, there's reasons for encouragement we've seen really since the pandemic, or the plandemic, as you put it very aptly. And I think that is that we start taking part in our city council meetings and our library board meetings in a way that conservatives, I think, have ignored for years and years, right? And as a de facto matter, it seems to be the liberals, or those with the degree in library science, who are going to be liberals coming from a state school, who get those positions. And I think there's room for encouragement, particularly in the red states, when you see the roles that conservatives have played at their local government and at the state government in trying to win back their Republican institutions.
Mm-hmm. And looking towards persuasion, because we have about 5 more minutes with you, and it's just a pleasure to have you. Thank you so much. Looking towards persuasion armed with knowledge, have you found, now you have kind of a self-selected group of sorts. You have real thinkers at Hillsdale College, kids who are taught how to think, not what to think. What have been some, shall we say, arguments about what we're talking about here? Most people, if they're going by the old labels, still believe liberalism is freedom and conservatism is despotism, because that has been the narrative. What's an argument that has helped to, shall we say, back this idea that the liberals
you know, apart from actual examples of which there are numerous, that liberals are now the new despots?
I think, so at Hillsdale, you know, the students have to read all of the, you know, classic texts, or we'd say the most important texts, and that includes a lot of leftist literature. And so the students all have to read, oh, arguments in critical theory, critical race theory, in gender theory. And I think once they're exposed to those arguments, they realize the level of control that that those on the left have planned, and the level of intervention. So, for example, you get into the whole trans movement. There they have the most private spaces, right? Who you shower with, who you go to the bathroom next to. These are all things where you're no longer going to have a bubble of security where, you know, for example, girls in women's sports can get together and have a place of their own. That's going to be controlled by some state board or by the federal government. I think when the students read the leftist text themselves, they realize, oh, no, the left has never had this idea of open-mindedness simply. It also means that they do distinguish, that there's nuances. So when they read many of those centrist liberals, they see their goals. Many of them are in favor of toleration of various opinions and so on. But how those tend not to play out when you see the way that government works. Give you an example. All the same liberals who were in favor of toleration were also in favor of government planning. So if you go to the 1960s, the era of the new economics, the entire economy was going to be controlled by state capitalist measures. So government would work with business to control production, consumption, you name it. And so I think students see the shortcomings of all of these movements on the left.
Absolutely. And to say nothing of the fact that there is a concerted effort to simply erase any kind of boundaries whatsoever, the boundaries of civility, the boundaries of good and evil, the boundaries between men and women, boundaries between government and citizen. And I'd be willing to bet that your students see that, too, by reading the actual texts. Tell everybody, thank you again for joining us. Tell everybody they can find you, follow you on, and get your book, Kevin Slack.
Sure. So if you just pull a search in any search engine, Kevin Slack, War in the American Republic, you'll find that book, or you can go right to Encounter Press and get a copy of it there.
I'd love to have you back again to talk more. Maybe we can delve deeper into all this scholarly knowledge. But if you want to know how liberals became despots, this is part of how to do that. Thank you again, Professor Kevin Slack. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll have one more guest. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Spouting Off with Karen Cataline.
We are being censored. America's news outlets no longer provide the truth. 90% of news outlets in the United States are controlled by 6 corporations. They're not out to tell you the truth of what's happening. They're out to tell you the picture of the world that they represent. The mission of the Epoch Times is to chase the truth, to ground all statements in facts, and prevent people from being misled. The Epoch Times is independent. We're not controlled by any special interest, and we never will be. This is a battle between truth and deceit, a battle between forces that would ensnare this country in ignorance, and between a media that wants to present you with the truth. Subscribe today to our digital edition at theepochtimes.com and join the Americans who are seeking truth and tradition. Read the difference on all your devices. We'd love to have you on board.
Are you tired of the same old snacks? Looking for something a little healthier than that bag of chips or candy bar? Even your average bag of trail mix these days is little more than peanuts, raisins, and candy-coated chocolate. Not very healthy, is it? Allow me to introduce you to White Mountain Munchies. Made from 100% all-natural ingredients, White Mountain Munchies combines unique flavors with nutritional value that will tingle your taste buds and strengthen and sustain your overall health and wellness. Eating good never tasted so good. From Maggie's Maple Madness to Hannah's Heavenly Harvest, Grayson's Getaway Goodies, and our limited edition Christmas blend, Jacoby's Jolly Jumble, White Mountain Munchies offers nutritious and delicious snacks that the whole family is sure to love. Pick yours up now through our easy-to-use online store at whitemountainmunchies.com. White Mountain Munchies, non-GMO when you're on the go.
Continuing the legacy started in 1904, Roger Pellerin of Gate City Monument Incorporated continues to provide the same high-quality monument, custom headstone, and stoneworking craftsmanship today that they built their reputation on over 100 years ago. Servicing Nashua, New Hampshire, as well as nearby areas in Massachusetts, such as Lowell, Billerica, Chelmsford, and beyond. From creating custom monuments to memorialize, to landscaping and granite work, or restorative services, each job is done to your satisfaction and is backed by decades of experience and integrity. If you're thinking about stonework, think Roger Pellerin of Gate City Monument. Visit online at gatecitymonument.com. Stop by and meet Roger at 321 West Hollis Street in Nashua, or call 603-883-7141. That's 603-883-7141. Gate City Monument, memorials of distinction for people who care.
Spouting Off with Karen Cataline will return in a moment.
Since 1930, United Way of Greater Nashua has been your trusted partner to fight for the health, education, and financial stability of every person in every community. When a low-income child needs access to dental care, or parents need quality after-school programs where their kids can learn and be safe, United Way is there. When a person with disabilities needs a supportive day program where they can thrive, or a family loses its home and needs a place to regain financial stability, United Way is there. When a homebound senior needs food and supportive social connections, or when it comes time to die with dignity, United Way is there. The programs supported by your United Way are the heart and soul of Greater Nashua. When you volunteer or donate to United Way, you lift up the community where you live and you work. As a highly regarded nonprofit with Charity Navigator and GuideStar, you can be sure that your donations will be used for the work of making Greater Nashua stronger, smarter, and safer. Learn more and connect with us at UnitedWayNashua.org.
Karen Cataline puts the Judeo in Judeo-Christian. Now back to Spouting Off.
Welcome back, everyone, to Spouting Off. It's such a pleasure to have you along with us. And we have our next guest on, another winner, if you don't mind my saying so. Not that I'm biased or anything. We have on the line right now Christian Watson, who is an outreach fellow for the Fund for American Studies and a host of the podcast Pensive Politics. Can't wait to talk to you about all this. Christian Watson joins us right now. Welcome to Spouting Off.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you too. First, tell everybody about, I was looking and reading right at the break about the Fund for American Studies. What does it do? And tell us a little bit about your role there.
Yeah, well, TFES is a wonderful organization which basically gives money to programs that help educate young people in the tradition of individual liberty and free markets and individual responsibility and a bunch of other things that are relevant. And TFAS offers a numerous number of fellowships for students who are interested in careers in journalism and academia and so on and so forth. So they're a wonderful organization. The late, great William F. Buckley had actually a role. He played a very big role in that organization, so I'm happy to be associated with them. I just basically go around college campuses in America, speaking on behalf of these very important issues with the help of TFAS, and I couldn't enjoy it more.
Well, you know, it's funny. I got to, you know, interject here or ask a question here about going to college campuses. I mean, no less than Jerry Seinfeld said he can't even do stand-up comedy at college campuses anymore, and he doesn't want to because of the narrow-mindedness in colleges that make it impossible to put forth any idea. I would think that a conservative idea like free markets, personal responsibility, and and freedom in general might not be so well received on college campuses. What have been some of your reactions?
Well, fortunately and unfortunately, I have not received a huge amount of pushback to my presence on college campuses. I say unfortunately because any pushback from people on the left is good pushback because it heightens the media awareness of my speech, which is always good because we need to get the message out there. But having said that, I have not received any significant pushback. So I have not had the experience people like Riley Gaines and other more prominent folks have had. Maybe sometime in my career I will have that experience. I hope I do.
And you look forward to it, right?
Yeah, of course, absolutely.
That'd be great. Are your audiences mostly the minority of either conservative students or students that appreciate this point of view? Or have you had people even in the audience who've said, you know, this is nonsense. We don't like what you're saying here.
I've only had one or two people in the course of my speeches who have sincerely pushed back.
Wow.
Against what I was saying.
Interesting.
Yeah, and most of the pushback is not really substantive. It's actually all very surface level.
Is it ever? I mean, you know, to say, is there a defensible argument against freedom and liberty? you know.
Well, I think there are a lot of very interesting points one can make on philosophical grounds about those terms. And, I mean, you have to really get into a lot of esoteric stuff to get to those points. But there are a lot of interesting points one can make. And I'm really used to, I study philosophy, I'm really used to dealing with people who have substantive critiques of the classical liberal system in America. I'm used to dealing with those kind of people. You go to college campuses, college leftist activists are not those kind of people. They don't have substantive critiques, which is a shame because there are plenty of critiques on both the left and the right of what we would call individual liberty that I think need to be dealt with because they're not dealt with. We're going to face an enemy that is much greater than just a bunch of shrieking TikTok kids. We're going to face an enemy that is organized, that is sophisticated, that is intelligent, and does have the ability to dramatically transform the political landscape of our country.
They're doing it right now. Let's drill down a little bit to an article that you wrote that is utterly fascinating and entices us to learn more. The title, The Delusion of the Left's Diversity Politics. Tell us more about that.
So, diversity politics is the idea that political processes should be governed by these notions of superficial diversity that are based on identity, and identity is based as then linked to an ideology. So, my argument is that diversity politics is destructive because it takes politics out of its proper condition, which should be to fundamentally secure individual rights, and to then, against the backdrop of a broader moral framework of natural law, that contains individual rights, whereas diversity politics puts politics into the hands of the subjective individual who may have particular characteristics that are given value arbitrarily by people. And that's not a very good thing because politics does not exist to serve at the behest of subjective opinion. It exists to serve objective standards. And so the argument is that if we want to have a healthy idea of politics, we must understand that this idea of diversity that is floated around today is not a proper idea of diversity. And we should instead embrace different kinds of diversity that are naturally occurring and that are necessary for society, not diversity that is not only not necessary for society, but destructive to it.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if this is related, but I feel like it is. When we had last week, seems like a year, the discussion about Budweiser and the transgender new mascot for Budweiser that conservatives did not take kindly to. The only defense that we had from the woman on the Twitter page saying how important it was to do that, can't remember her name, was that this is inclusive. And it's such a false, it's a lie to call it inclusive because if they're pushing down the throats certain things on a group of people in order to exclude them. My point is that it seems like everything they promise and say and they label things has the direct and opposite outcome of what they claim they want. If they wanted to be inclusive, they wouldn't have all these policies that excludes people that they disagree with, like conservatives, people who believe there's, you know, there's actually biological difference between men and women and that gender is not fluid. They want to exclude those people under a title that says inclusion. Isn't it also true that diversity is the same thing? They call it diversity, but really, they don't want any intellectual diversity at all.
Well, inclusion should be taken as part of a broader project, not merely as a word in itself. If you're going to understand the left, you have to understand how they interpret certain terms. So inclusion is the idea. It's basically how you implement the first two words, diversity and equity. It's the result of diversity and equity under their framing. So diversity under their framing, again, has to do with skin color or race or sex or any other characteristic that they believe has a fundamental, let's say, it gives you some sort of knowledge about particular areas in society. Then equity is the distribution of resources on the basis of that diversity, and inclusion is the result. So when you think of inclusive, you may think, well, inclusion would mean getting a bunch of different perspectives involved in a process. That's not how they define it. And this is the trick of their word games, because you may think
my point exactly. It is a word game.
But it's very important to realize that under their particular context, inclusion means something entirely different than what you or I may think it means. So we should confront it on their context and explain why that context is epistemically erroneous. Because by doing that, you cover all bases. You don't merely say, well, my definition is right, because that's not really useful. You also establish why the definition is wrong.
So help us understand how we can use that as an argument, because some people, their hair just goes on fire. This is not diversity, right? And if you get involved in a semantic argument, then you lose the point. What's the best point to make in order to counter these word games, this trickery that has different outcomes than what is promised and claimed?
Well, you reject the premise. You simply say that the way you're using inclusion is not appropriate. It is destructive. And here is what we should instead use. We should reject the premise. You know, sometimes these ideas don't warrant you to go too deep into them. You can reject
the
premise.
I love it. It's
right.
True.
Sometimes they don't. But yeah. Sometimes they don't. But sometimes they do. But you can really just reject the premise and say, okay, no, this is not what we would per se call inclusion. And then you can then say, in the broader context that inclusion is included in, like diversity and equity, there are also problems with this, right? How you use equity is actually not equity. Equity itself is an old term that used to mean relating to justice, which has now been lost. Diversity itself means a bunch of other things. So you have to really put them on the defensive. You have to make them justify, from an epistemic point of view, how they use these words and these terms. And if they continue to default back on using the words and the terms to justify the words and the terms, that's what we call a circular argument. You can point that out. So there are plenty of ways to, push this and to argue about it. But I think more than anything else, we should all realize that there is a deeper problem here. And it's a deeper problem of shared knowledge that, you know, society thrives when we have the same basis for dealing with conceptually complex issues. Mm-hmm. And that basis, a long time ago, was the fundamental emphasis on human reason against the backdrop of a world that is knowable. These days, the world is not knowable to the left unless it's interpreted through the lens of the subjective. And the subjective is not knowable to anyone else except the person who is experiencing it. And this is the problem. You can never establish any sort of standard because it will always run athwart of someone's idea of what reality is, what truth is. Mm-hmm. So again, we have to, on a philosophical level, dig into this terrain and rip out the corrupt roots of these trees.
We're talking to Christian Watson, fellow at the Fund for American Studies. We'll tell everybody how they can find that, and if they'd like to contribute, they can do that. As I heard you talk about having this debate and rejecting the premise, which is a superb bit of advice, I got to thinking, well, it's hard. What do we do when we're trying to have a debate about something on which we were never asked our opinion? This is true tyranny and despotism, which we talked about just a moment ago, in which these ideas are being foisted upon us when there was no debate. One day, all of a sudden, they introduce diversity, equity, inclusion. They introduce that there is no longer any boy or girl. They introduce that now that we've hated men, we're going to allow men to destroy women's sports. On and on it goes. Nobody debated these things. Nobody was asked their opinion about things. What do you do about that?
Well, ultimately, you cannot control whether folks asked you or not about your opinion, but you can't control how you assert your opinion. So you simply assert your opinion in a way that's rational, in a way that calls back to philosophy and first principles, and you'll be all right. I don't concern myself about what folks ask me. I mean, no one ever asked me if I wanted to be defined by my race. You know, I'm a black man. No one ever asked me that, but I don't really care because I can assert my individuality. No one ever asked me if, as a conservative, I wanted to be associated with ideas that are destructive to poor people or whatever. But, you know, I am associated with that by some people on the left, so I simply assert the truth that I am not associated with those ideas and that they are misinterpreting my ideas. You know, the Stoics had some really valuable advice. It doesn't really matter what happens in the external world because you can't control it, but it matters how you respond to it. I think that's what we should do.
That's pretty good. It's a hard thing to do when you're watching your country being dismantled before your eyes, but it's still good advice. And I'm sure that you are probably a bigger target than most because, you know, I've always had an incredibly soft spot in my heart for black conservatives, black liberty-loving Americans who can make an argument, because it's like you're treated like a mascot. Not quite as much for a Jewish conservative like myself, but it's like you're treated as a mascot. You know, you're gonna be petted and told it's all okay. And oh yes, if you don't vote for me, you ain't black. We have about a minute. If you could comment on that, and then, if possible, tell everybody where they can find you and follow you at the Fund for American Studies, TFAS.
Yep. So everyone can go find me at my Twitter, which is going to be Official C. Watson, and the Fund for American Studies is going to be, the website is tfas.org. Thank you so much for having me, and I really appreciate coming on.
You hear the music, and I asked that question much too late, but I am grateful to have you on. Would love to have you on again, and best of luck with your podcast, Pensive Politics. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, we'll have another episode of Spouting Off Thursday and Friday, 1 p.m. Eastern. Stay tuned. Don't go anywhere, and keep standing up for freedom.